Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
Since the 3rd of December, Tottenham have beaten Royal Antwerp, Stoke City, Leeds United, Brentford Marine, Sheffield United, Wickham Wanderers, West Bromwich Albion, Wolfsburg AC twice, Burnley Fulham, Crystal Palace and Dinamo Zagreb. In that time, they've lost to Liverpool, Leicester City, Liverpool, Brighton, Chelsea, Everton, Manchester City, West Ham and Arsenal. Are Jose Mourinho's Tottenham just an ordinary Europa League level team now? Are they just the best of the rest? My name's Jack Pitbrook, you're listening to the View from the Lane podcast. I'm joined, as always, by James Moore.
You're not James Moore. You wish you were, but you're not.
Did I say I am James Moore?
You were about to, yeah. But we're rolling we're going now, we're recording. Let's go.
I mean, look, you're the man. James, what is... I don't imagine you're very happy after what happened yesterday.
No, not especially. I thought before this, we said we were going to start with the positive and we were going to talk about Lamella and it was all going to be nice for 5 minutes at
we
the start.
Are,
should,
yeah.
Should we just do that now?
Yeah, let's go straight into the positives because, look, there'll be plenty of time to moan later, but let's start by celebrating what I thought was one of my favourite Tottenham goals of the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, it was an absolutely incredible goal, and it is genuinely criminal that I'm now going to have to pretend it never happened because I can't acknowledge that happened now. I just won't. I will not acknowledge that goal. That goal does not exist. That has been struck from the records for me. It is a shame. But, you know, coming in a game where, one, Spurs were absolutely abysmal for, if we're being generous, 75 minutes. Two, the player who scored the goal was then sent off in equally trademark fashion, you have to say. And three, Spurs lost the game and blew a 1-0 lead against Arsenal, of all teams. I'm not so sure it's going to be like a cherished memory. It's going to be, you know, it can be like in a montage of Lamella's best moments when he leaves, but it's not going to go down with, you know, the Gazza goal in the semi-final in 91 or whatever, which is a shame because it's as good a goal on a technical level as I think I've ever seen a Tottenham player score, but it's now a tarnished memory.
It was an amazing moment. I mean, it had that thing that the great goals do, which is shock factor. Like, even though... you could argue, well, he has scored a Rabona before and he has tried them before. And because he did it against Asteras Tripolis in the Europa League in 2014, it's maybe not as special. But come on, that was 6.5 years ago. Players don't score Rabonas in the Premier League.
Has there been one before in the Premier League? I can't think of one.
I can't think of a Rabona goal. Like, most people's familiarity with a Rabona in the Premier League is that clip of David Dunn falling over.
I think Harry Kewell might have. Maybe it was almost like a sort of trademark for Harry, like as a cross, I mean, not as a shot.
Oh, okay.
I just have memories of Harry Kewell doing it a few times.
Yeah, I remember Ndombele doing one, but the idea of scoring a nutmeg Rabona in a derby where it goes through
it's like an amazing thing.
Legs
into the bottom corner.
Curls into the bottom corner. Like, it gets Asteras Tripolis. I can't remember that clearly, but I think he had quite a lot more of the goal to aim at, and I think maybe the keeper was on the ground or whatever, so he just had to get it up and over and in. Whereas this one like skimmed along the ground, whipping through Partey's legs, round past Leno into the only bit of the goal he could get to. It was ridiculous.
I tell you the difference between the two is that first one in the Europa League, it was entirely because he's so one-footed that he had to like bring his left foot around and hit it with that left foot, even though it would have been kind of more logical to hit it with his right when the ball came to him in that position, because he had space and time on the edge of the box to do it. This one, if he had kind of taken a toss, you know, if he'd kind of readjusted himself and hit it with his right foot, the ball wouldn't have moved in the same trajectory. The trajectory was absolutely perfect, like you say, through Partey's legs and into the bottom corner. Like, it was the perfect use of the ball in that instant. And, you know, it probably is still slightly linked to him not having a right foot. But, I mean, it's a ludicrously good goal. And like I say, it is just a shame that it wasn't the winner or even, you know, a goal in a game that Spurs ultimately drew.
The interesting thing about the goal for me, or one of them, is that it was so... Like, we've talked recently about how we think Lamella is in the team more for his all-round game, for his running, his pressing, his fouling, and that the kind of Argentine number 10 technical brilliance, which he has kind of gone out of his game a little bit, like he hasn't really shown much technical skill in the final third for a few years. So this was this ran very much counter to that. It felt like maybe he'd been something he'd been building up to in secret for years.
It was a game that just summed him up completely, wasn't it? The two sides to him. And those two things will always come together. You've always got to take the rough with the smooth of Eric Lamella. For every incredible Rabona goal there is, like, I think that might actually have been his first red card. Do you know if that's right? I think I saw someone tweet that last night. That is genuinely insane, because it is. I mean, even if you ignore everything else and just look at that that battle of the bridge, I mean, he could have been sent off about 10 times in that game alone. Yeah. It's crazy that he's not had a red card before. But yeah, those two things do come together, and that is his game, isn't it? It's that, it's the kind of chaos, is these mad skills and this ludicrous aggression, and you know. Those two things kind of counterbalance each other, and it makes him like a useful player, I think. The thing that really, really annoyed me, actually, aside from Spurs being absolute trash, was Alan Smith describing that goal as having trundled in. I mean, what?
Yeah.
I mean, no disrespect to Alan Smith, and we know the kind of striker he was, and he was not the kind of striker that was scoring goals like that. But to say that trundled in... It's absolutely ludicrous. Like the commentary for that goal was just...
Yeah.
It doesn't matter to me as much now because I'm not going to watch it again. But it's just like really mind-tiring just to kind of... I mean, maybe he was just kind of confused. He didn't realise what had happened, and he couldn't really tell that, you know, Lamella had brought one leg round the other to hit the ball like that. But it was just so... For a goal of that, like, magnitude, you know, in a North London derby, I got, you know, that skill to kind of be described in that way was really sort of underwhelming.
Yeah, completely. And it's funny you should say that, because it really chimed with me with something that Tom Rosenthal was saying on Football Cliches Pod last week, which I did with him. And Tom was saying that one of his big gripes about modern football is that as the Premier League becomes more about sort of mad skills and creativity, the problem is that the media, and especially TV commentators, don't really have the vocabulary to describe that, and they often look a little bit dumbfounded by the skills that an Ndombele or a Nicolas Pepe or whoever will use to get past players, and they don't really have the words to describe it. And I felt that very much yesterday, because I thought that I don't want to criticise Alan Smith and Martin Tyler, because I think they're both really good, but I felt like they didn't really have the sort of instantly accessible vocabulary to describe and analyse what it was.
Yeah, which is weird given we had seen, you know, the same player score a goal like that before.
And if you haven't heard Tom and I discussing this with Adam on the Football Cliches podcast last week, here's a clip.
The most you get is, oh, with a lovely bit of skill. So it goes past with a lovely bit of skill. It's so specific. It's like someone going, oh, that's a lovely bit of goal. Do you know what I mean? Like, we have other words to describe these things. These skills have specific names, right? And I think pundits know three. They know the step over, the nutmeg, and the Cruyff turn. You might get someone describing them as a Cruyff, but, you know, they're supposed to be experts in the game, right? So, you know, you've got the roulette, the elastico, the Aurelia, the Dravella, the fake kick, the mule kick, the Biava, the hocus pocus, the Acocha, the Rabona, the Rivellina, the fake pullback, the cut, the Matthews cut, the rainbow, the Ronaldo chop, the inside hook, the pullback V, the single lunge, double lunge, and the seal dribble. They've got all
my
of those.
Goodness.
But they never even refer to them. And players, they know how important these skills are. You've seen it in training when they're doing the rondo and someone does a nutmeg, they all go nuts.
Right now, you can subscribe to The Athletic for a special price of £3.99 per month for 6 months. That's 40% off the full price of a subscription. You'll enjoy great analysis and in-depth features from the very best football writers around, as well as ad-free versions of all of our podcasts. So go to theathletic.com/SpursPod to take advantage of this special 40% discount. That's theathletic.com/SpursPod. One interesting thing about the Rabona is that, firstly, it was literally Spurs' only shot on target until about 72 minutes when Lamella had a header easily saved by Leno. But I think it kind of, even though it feels like it's in massive contrast to Mourinho's general play, in the sense that this was a moment of brilliant skill and Mourinho's football is quite dour. In another sense, it was totally at one with the Mourinho approach, because, you know, sometimes watching a Mourinho team, and this has been true of Tottenham this season at times, it feels as if the only plan is that one of our attackers will do something brilliant. And that, you know, and if you have Kane, Bale and Son, that will, or Dele, that will often work because you have brilliant individuals who are capable of moments of magic in the final third. But Tottenham were nowhere creatively yesterday, James. Yeah. Nowhere at all. And I thought that was really bad.
I mean, as you say, you know, if you've got like a combination of sort of four or five of Kane, Son, Bale, Dele, and Ndombele, Lamella, maybe even Bergwijn, Lucas in the team, then, you know, you can kind of see that there's scope for being quite a few good moments in a game. And there have been obviously games this season where that has worked well. But without that kind of attacking framework to fall back on, I think it makes it harder to win a game. I know this might almost seem counterintuitive, but I think it makes it harder to win a game when you're not playing well. Because I think that when players' confidence drops a little bit, you know, if in the first 15, 20 minutes of a game, like yesterday, you don't really have any of the ball. Like, your confidence, I mean, you know, and again, obviously, Lamella scored a ludicrous goal after this happened in this game, so maybe this is a bad example. But I would say generally, you know, if you start a game without having much of the ball, you're getting kind of passed all over the pitch. I kind of feel like the confidence to do things like that is gonna wane quite quickly. And although it did happen yesterday, you can kind of see that those moments are not going to come quite as readily when a team is struggling as it would, you know, if they're playing well. So when you've got momentum, I can kind of see, and Spurs obviously did have momentum coming into this game, I can kind of see that the players would have confidence to try those things, but maybe if things aren't going well, it's going to be harder to, like, for those things to click into gear, if you know what I mean. It just feels like it's sort of, you're leaving a lot of things to chance there, rather than having like a clear system. And for someone who I would describe as being quite methodical, or like Mourinho, it does seem quite odd to feel like that is the approach to attacking play. And I know, you know, you wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago with quite a lot of emphasis on how the attacking players trained. And I think that kind of tallied with what a lot of the perceptions of Mourinho, the pre-existing perceptions of Mourinho had been from his other clubs. And things that have been written about him before, I think, particularly at Real Madrid. And look, clearly that methodology has worked for him for the most part for his career. You know, he's had success at every club he's been at, even if things have eventually turned at Chelsea the second time and Manchester United and Real Madrid. But yeah, I'm not so sure that it's going to be something that's going to carry Spurs through bad moments. And we made a point of saying that Burnley and Crystal Palace and Fulham were not bad teams last week, which is obviously still the case now. But it's one thing to do it against teams with inferior players. But when you're up against teams of similar or better quality, then it kind of feels like it's a bit of a risk.
Yeah, I certainly think it is a bit of a risk relying on the individual moment of magic. And a lot of the time it will happen. And Spurs have had a lot of individual moments of magic this year. You know, Kane has played brilliantly. Son has played very well. Bale's just started to come in the last few weeks. You know, they are capable of doing some really good stuff. But I think you're right, James. I think there is a bit of, doesn't feel that sustainable, I think, sometimes at times. And, you know, the injury to Son being a case in point, in the sense that if Son had stayed fit, then I think Spurs' plan would have been more likely to work because, I mean, this is something we'll come back to later on the show, but if you're playing that kind of low block counter-attacking style, then Son is perfect for it because Son is like one of the best counter-attacking players in the whole league. But then you take Son out of the team, then suddenly the team doesn't know how to counter, in the same way that when you take Kane out of Spurs' team, they don't really know how to attack. Like, they are incredibly dependent on individuals, I think. And but yeah, we can come on to that. The one thing I want to get onto is kind of the game plan, really. So Mourinho was asked in the press conference on Thursday night, I think, after the Dinamo Zagreb game, how will you approach this game against Arsenal, given that you're 7 points ahead of them? And Mourinho said, "I look up, I don't look down. If Arsenal were 7 points ahead of us, I'd look up to them. But because we have 7 points more than them, I don't look down." And I thought the implication of that statement was, Spurs are going to go on the front foot. They're not going to try and play like they would do against City or Liverpool, sitting deep and countering. I thought it was a suggestion that because Spurs are better than Arsenal, they would treat it as if they, you know, the Burnley or the Palace game, where we saw Spurs play much more on the front foot, much more aggressively. In both those games, they scored four brilliant goals. They really got the best out of Bale. And they just looked like a team that was really clicking going forward. And so I must admit, I was quite surprised to see how defensive Spurs were, James. They were so sat back in their own half. They looked very scared of Arsenal and much more worried about trying to stop Arsenal and then trying to catch them on the break rather than taking the game to a team who has massive defensive vulnerabilities. And I get the impression that, I mean, not only did it not work, but I feel like a lot of Spurs fans are pretty unhappy with that as an approach for a derby.
Yeah, I mean, I did think it was strange. And I know a few of the people that tweeted us this morning have asked this question or alluded to this point. It felt like quite an attacking team that was then set out to play really defensively. Like, it wasn't, you know, if he had lined up with the same sort of system that he had used in the previous game against Arsenal or that Man City game with Sissoko in there with Højbjerg, like, deeper in midfield to basically create that back six that we kind of talked about a bit in the autumn. And then you kind of had Bale, Kane and Son, I guess, and Ndombele still. It's like the attacking four and you're kind of saying, here's the back six, that's the front four. Just kick the ball out of this end and get it to these four and see what they can do. I could kind of see the logic in that. Even if I thought playing on the back foot against this Arsenal team who are 10th in the league and I don't think an especially great team, you know, a good team with some good players, but I don't mean they're a great team. No, even if I thought it was a mistake to play like that or not the best approach to play like that, I could see the logic in it. But to play the same system that they played in the last couple of games against, you know, Burnley and, or similar to how they're playing against Burnley and Palace, say, and then kind of try and sit in and play in the counter-attacking in exactly the same way, you know, with Lucas as the 10, with Ndombele sat deep and not really doing that much, I can't really see the logic. And I know when, you know, there have been moments in the season when Spurs have sat in and it so obviously felt wrong. You know, the second half of that Wolves game, for example, towards the end of that Palace game away. You know, and Mourinho has made a point of saying he wasn't asking them to do that. They've done that themselves. They've kind of retreated and sat deeper. If that keeps happening, one way or another, you kind of have to put that back on the manager, right? Either he is advising them, telling them to do that, or they're not listening to what he's saying, in which case the messages he's trying to give them just aren't coming across. And, I mean, if that was the case, that suggests he doesn't really have the authority in the dressing room that he needs to have to manage the team. Now, I have no idea which of those two things are true, but I don't really see... I mean, is there a third option there? Is there something I'm missing? Because he's kind of seemed to imply in what he said after the game. Now, he talked about individual players hiding, which I guess is a slightly different thing. But at no point did he say after the game, we wanted to sit deep and play on the counter attack. This is why we wanted to do that. That wasn't really how I read what he said.
This, I think, is one of the big questions about Tottenham this season. And I don't fully know the answer. It's why... Mourinho does say that there have been times when the players have been more have looked more defensive than he would want them to be, particularly in the second half of the Fulham 1-1 at home, for example, the second half of the Palace 1-1 away, I think the Wolves game. Mourinho's line has been, well, I didn't tell them to be as defensive as they were. And so the extent to which that was the players disobeying Mourinho, or was it just, or maybe Mourinho isn't being straight with us, or maybe the players had fell back on their instincts, which are to defend rather than to push up. I don't know exactly what the answer is, but this is something I've been thinking about a lot since the game, is how much should we blame the players? I mean, Mourinho was pretty hard on the players afterwards. He said in the press conference, we didn't have defensive intensity to press and to run, to be really aggressive and to win duels and second balls. We didn't have any of that. We also didn't have the intensity to play. Everybody was dropping back to have the ball at their feet. Nobody was attacking the gap apart from Lucas. And he also accused some of the players of hiding. Now, I didn't think the players were great, and I thought there were a lot of non-performances. You can put that down to tiredness, or maybe it's a mental thing, but I thought Bale was barely in the game. Kane wasn't in the game until 20 minutes left. And Ndombele was a complete passenger. He looks exhausted. Doherty had a really hard game, I think, again. Sonny obviously went off after 15 minutes. It's not his fault. Lucas was probably the only bright spark going forward until the ending. So yeah, I'm kind of in two minds on this, James, about the extent to which I blame the players. What do you think?
I mean, look, you can't separate those two things and say the players are completely without blame and it's all on the manager. It's just completely ludicrous. As you say, Bale wasn't in the game at all. Kane barely had a touch in the first 75 minutes, really. You know, it didn't look like he was going to affect the game at all until that cross to Dele Alli. And when was that, like kind of 15, 10 minutes left, maybe? I mean, it looked like he was just going to kind of not have any impact on the game at all, which obviously is incredibly rare. Yeah, and then Ndombele in this deeper role, Zanoh is a thing we're going to come on to in a minute. I'm not quite so sure that works quite as well as everyone expected it to sort of 6 weeks ago. But yeah, it's a difficult one. I mean, I was a bit surprised to see. I mean, I think when he was talking about players hiding, who do you think he was talking about? Because to me, it kind of felt like it must have been Bale, particularly because he came off so early.
Yeah, I think he kind of rode back on. So that's something he said on the TV, and then in the press conference, I thought he kind of... Don't want to say he rode back on it, but I think he was a bit... He didn't double down on it, put it like that. I thought obviously Bale wasn't really in the game at all. I don't know if it was one game too many for him, perhaps, or...
It's not unreasonable for Bale. I mean, you know, obviously it's very disappointing, and we're not kind of completely admonishing him of blame. But I don't think it's unreasonable for Bale to have a not particularly great game after what he's done in the last, say, month. And
agreed.
That is... You kind of expect, you know, a player who's hardly played for months and months, 18 months, 2 years, basically, to then come in and play a lot in the last 3 or 4 weeks. There was always going to be this dip. And it is unfortunate that it's come in this game against Arsenal, you know, one that everyone, including Mourinho, would have been absolutely desperate to win. But I've got to say, it does kind of stick in the craw a little bit. And you say he's maybe rode back a little bit in the kind of in the written press conference. Yeah, and obviously the interview does on Sky is immediately after the game when emotions are going to be running that much higher. So, you know, maybe he realised what he said was a bit unfair. But I mean, Gareth Bale, you know, if you think of where Spurs and Mourinho were before that little run of form from Gareth Bale, I mean, they were sort of 9th, 10th in the league, looking like they were just going to kind of limp over the line and finish like properly, genuinely mid-table. You wouldn't have given them any chance at all of winning the League Cup or the Europa League. And Mourinho would have been under massive, massive pressure. You know, he could have been sat in that Sky Sports studio on Sunday afternoon if it wasn't for Gareth Bale, you know, waiting for Paddy Power to phone again. I mean, that's the reality of it. And he did this earlier in the season with Dier and Aurier as well. You know, Aurier and Dier were two of the better performers, I suppose, in the first half of the season. In the second, they both had a bad game against Liverpool. They were out of the team. And, you know, I mean... Aurier obviously has had a lot of matches since because Doherty has struggled so much. But Dier, we've just kind of, you know, and I'm not saying this is a wrong decision, but the second he had one bad game, he's just out of the team more or less permanently. And it does seem a bit odd to me that he doesn't really seem to have, maybe I'm being unfair, it doesn't seem like he has loyalty, especially to the players who have sort of dug him out of a hole. It does seem a bit odd.
He was both very critical of the players initially, and then I think... on the TV, and then in the press conference, he was more critical. I feel like he's slightly changed tack to be more critical of the referee. He said the one thing worse than our first half performance was Michael Oliver and Paul Tierney.
I mean, he was very critical of the referee on Sky as well.
On the penalty. Yeah, okay. I think it's, as ever with this kind of thing, you wonder whether it's emotional, or is it he's trying to get a rise out of the players and trying to make sure it doesn't happen again next week. Remember, he was not happy after the West Ham game, which was their last defeat before that run of wins, and after that game he said that there were problems at the club that even he couldn't fix, and you know, I don't know if it's causing, you know, correlations and causation, but after that West Ham game, they went on a really good run and they won 5 in a row.
You can't keep doing that, though, surely. I mean, that just can't be healthy for anyone in that dressing room. You know, you have kind of 4 or 5 good results, then you have a bad result, and then the manager's kind of slamming the players again. I mean, and again, this isn't to say that Mourinho is entirely to blame for that defeat and the players are not to blame at all. But I just don't think, if you're a player in that dressing room, you know, you walk off a pitch after a bad performance, your first bad performance in a few weeks, you've been on a decent run of form, you've played well, you're sat there in the dressing room, you're really disappointed to lose to Arsenal, you open your phone up, you know, have a look, and then you open up Twitter or Instagram or WhatsApp or whatever, and all your friends or other people are saying, Mourinho obviously hammering player X or whatever. I mean, how are you going to feel after that? It's just not, I don't know. I think you're right. I think what you're kind of suggesting is right, that it was probably like an emotional reaction to being really disappointed at losing the game. But when you've been a manager for 20 years and a high-profile manager at the biggest clubs in Europe for 15, 16 years, I don't know. It seems odd to me that you would do that and not have the control there, to me. He's been in higher-pressure situations than he is now with Spurs. I mean, particularly at Madrid. And I think towards the end at Inter, when the media were like going absolutely crazy, I'd be amazed if he struggled that much to control his emotions.
Yeah, and it's like we discussed with Dom Fifield the other day when we were talking about the Mourinho season at Chelsea in 2015, is that, you know, you can't keep pulling that lever forever, because the more you pull it, the less effect it'll have. And then eventually the players will just get bored of the kind of constant hot air and empty words. And I do have a bit of it. We'll get onto this, but I do have a bit of a sense that yesterday's game took us back a bit into the sort of dark days of January. It just felt a little bit too like the Chelsea, Brighton, Liverpool, Man City, Leicester defeats of the winter, where Spurs weren't really in the game. They weren't really competitive. They put on a kind of siege in the last 15 minutes, but it's like, well, why didn't you play that well? Why didn't you play that way at the start?
Yeah, to me,
why didn't you attack at the start?
Yeah. It felt like Mourinho's excuse. I mean, have a go at the referee, fine. I mean, I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that, but whatever. But to kind of come out after the game and say they were knackered, I think maybe would have been the approach I would prefer to have seen. That kind of lean more into the siege mentality rather than kind of divide and conquer.
Just one more quick question before we wrap up this section. This is from Adam, the real Flanners on Twitter. Do you think on the pod that you overrate Ndombele and think it's time to stop playing him deeper? He looks good on social media in clips, but he doesn't do enough to influence the game and goes missing. Adam, it's a good question. I think the answer to that is, well, maybe we do overrate Ndombele. I mean, I'm not going to apologise for absolutely loving his style and loving watching him play. I think he's a very entertaining player. I think he's capable of being very useful for Spurs. I did think he was good against Dinamo Zagreb on Thursday night. At the same time, I think he's exhausted, and I don't think he... I think you're right that the switch of him into deeper midfield, it produces some good... I think he's still like a moments player rather than a control of the game player. He's not going to be like a Luka Modric or even a Moussa Dembele, but he's someone who will do, you know, a handful of really good things over the course of 90 minutes.
I'd agree with that, but then that, to me, suggests he should play as a number 10 rather than... in that kind of midfield too. I think, I mean, I know a lot of people were really, there was a real clamour for him to play a bit deeper kind of 6 or 7 weeks ago, and obviously, you know, he has had some good performances in that time, but I think there've also been quite a few games where, well, I don't want to say he's coasted, because I don't think it's like that sort of suggests he's kind of taken his foot off the gas a little bit, but he's not been a sort of constant presence on the ball, which is maybe what, you know, like you're saying, Modric or Dembele you'd expect to see much more of in a game like that.
Yeah.
And also I think we might have kind of slipped back a little bit into him coming off after an hour of more or less every game.
Oh, yeah.
Which may be sort of ties into what you're saying about him being tired, which again would be understandable. That is a big thing. You know, there's a lot of players in that team who have played a lot of matches. You know, if you think of Højbjerg and Ndombele, Kane, obviously Son is going to presumably sit out a couple now, but he's played a lot of matches too, so that is a factor. And we talked before about the fringe players not really doing it, or not many of them doing it over the course of the season, so you know, it is kind of understandable that you would lean into using a lot of those players or a smaller number of players for a lot of minutes. So maybe this is an obvious kickback of that. So let's maybe this international break that's coming up actually the week after next may actually be quite well timed for Spurs, I think, particularly if international matches do get canned.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Someone who's played a lot of minutes this season is Heung-min Son, who is Tottenham's third most used player. And he pulled up with a hamstring injury in the first half on Sunday afternoon. So you got Højbjerg first with 3,339, Lloris second with 3,270. And then Son with an incredible 3,140 before you get to Kane, Davis, and then Dyer. Now, those are huge numbers. Like, you know, equivalent players at other Premier League clubs have not played as many. Also, they're huge numbers because of how Son plays, James. Like, Son's a sprinter. You know, it's not easy to play every game if you're a keeper or holding midfielder, but it's easier than if you're someone whose game relies on lots and lots of sprinting. And it's amazing. I think this is Son's first injury since he broke his arm at Villa Park in February last year.
He had that hamstring injury, didn't he, in October, at half time in the Newcastle game, when Mourinho kind of said at the time, we'll be without him for a while, and then he came back for the next league game. He missed the Maccabi Haifa and Chelsea League Cup games, and then came back for Manchester United, I think it was. I guess Spurs will be hoping that it's a similar sort of period of time. Obviously, that would mean him missing two bigger games, the second leg in Zagreb and Villa at the weekend. So yeah, it'll be difficult. And obviously, Lamella is going to be missing for Villa as well. So that does kind of pose a question for Mourinho, who he's going to bring in. I mean, if he wants to stick with Lucas as the number 10, then I suppose it means Bergwijn is going to play. Or the other option is shifting Lucas out wide and bringing in Dele Alli, I guess.
Yeah, it's the decline of Bergwijn is strange, I think. Like, I had a Dutch journalist call me up the other day and ask me about this, because it's in Holland it's quite a surprise, because he was, you know, he was one of the superstars of the Eredivisie, and then he's came to Tottenham, scored that famous goal against Man City, scored the famous goal against Manchester United when football resumed in June after the first big COVID pause. And then he's had, you know, he's been in and out of the team this year. And there were times where he played a lot. Like, he was, you know, he had that run of three starts in a row when Spurs lost to Liverpool, Brighton and Chelsea back in January. And Chelsea was his last league game. And that was more than a month ago, his last league start. And since then, he's only started the FA Cup game at Goodison and the sort of fairly dead Wolfsburg or AC at home Europa League game. So yeah, he's been well out of the picture. And I can see, you know, I'm sure his confidence is pretty low. He hasn't really struggled in front of goal, but I actually thought he was okay when he came on against Dinamo Zagreb last week. I do like Bergwijn. I would like to see him a bit more involved.
Yeah, it just seemed like a strange one. I mean, I guess you'd probably say he has been the biggest casualty of Gareth Bale's sort of resurgence, because it just meant there have been that many fewer minutes for sort of attacking wide players, I guess. Not that he necessarily would have played on the right. He seems to have played on the left more this season, which I think is generally where he slipped a bit better. It is a bit of a weird one. I mean, he really did feel like he was one of Mourinho's kind of trusted lieutenants in that kind of sweet spot, as we were talking about before, in the autumn. You know, he was kind of doing that defensive shift from an attacking position that you would kind of expect Mourinho to really love. And he was playing pretty well in those games. It's easy to read too much into some of these things, but you do think, like, there was quite a big fuss about some of the abuse he got on social media after that Liverpool game. If you remember, he missed...
Yeah,
quite a good chance. I mean, it's not like a sitter, but it was a decent opportunity at 1-1. And you do wonder whether that actually maybe had quite a big effect on his confidence, and that since then, you know, obviously he hasn't scored a goal this season in any competition, which is pretty unusual for a player like that. Although I wouldn't say he's missed loads of chances. It's not really felt like he's missed chance after chance. It's not really been one of those seasons where a player has just never looked like they're never going to score. He just hasn't really had opportunities. I think the thing to remember with Bergwijn is he's really young, isn't he? He's still kind of only 21, 22, I think. So... you know, clearly he is kind of still one for the future. I do wonder whether he might end up going out on loan next season if, say, Sessegnon comes back into the fold. And I know there are kind of issues over homegrown quotas and whatever, particularly if they're in Europe again next season. So maybe that might be a good option if they can get him like a Premier League loan somewhere, you know, with a view to coming back and having an opportunity the season after. That might not be the worst thing in the world, in my opinion. But if it feels like he needs to play, he feels like one of those players where he needs to build up a bit of a head of steam. He needs to get a bit of rhythm, you know. And if he went to, I was going to say a mid-table team, another mid-table team, or like an early promoted team or whatever next season, and, you know, got a bit of a run and scored a few goals and got a bit of confidence and, you know, had fans chanting his name and whatever, then maybe you'd see a different player. But he does look, and again, it's really easy to kind of read too much into people's facial expressions, but he doesn't look happy. It makes me quite sad. Seeing him kind of sat on the bench looking really like just having like real sadness in his eyes, you know, it's sad.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So it's a big week coming up with Dinamo Zagreb's second leg on Thursday. Spurs obviously 2-0 up already. I think they should be fine. I don't know what sort of team he'll play because, of course, Villa on Sunday night is a massive game in the league. I feel like top for a while I thought that the everywhere in the league below City would be very fluid. I now feel like Leicester, Man United and Chelsea feels quite solid as second, third and fourth, which makes me think it'll be harder for any of the teams outside the top four, whether that's Everton, Liverpool, West Ham or Tottenham, to actually nick fourth place. I imagine that what is currently the top four will stay the top four for the last nine games of the season.
Yeah. I mean, Chelsea look so good defensively, don't they? That even when they have an off day in front of goal, I think as I did at the weekend, they're probably not going to get beaten too often. So yeah, I mean, obviously they've got a head of steam as well, haven't they? Now they've got like sort of 10 unbeaten or whatever it is since Lampard left. Leicester haven't had the wobble that we kind of expected them to do when they got the injuries. Yeah. It's kind of a bit annoying. It'll be interesting to see how much desire there is to finish sort of fifth, because, you know, clearly that was quite a big deal last season. There was quite a lot of emphasis put on the fact that being in Europe was really important. But I don't know, will there be the same appetite to do that having if they go deep in the competition this season and don't win it? Will they want that kind of draining experience again next season, or would they rather kind of have that Chelsea 16-17 vibe of not being in Europe at all and just going for the title and being able to just kind of focus entirely on the league?
I don't think they can afford not to be in Europe, both financially and from sort of self-esteem perspective. What I hope will be the first post-COVID season of fans back at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, which will actually make it the first full season, hopefully, of fans at games, if possible. The idea of not being in Europe, I think, would be horrible. But it does speak to what we were talking about at the top of the show, which is Spurs need to remember how to beat good teams, because, you know, for them, the Spurs can have a good end to the season, but they'd either have to beat City in the League Cup, they'd have to have a brilliant run in the Premier League, probably including beating Man United and Leicester City over the run-in, or they'd have to win the Europa League, which contains some very good teams, like Ajax, Milan, Man United, Roma, Arsenal. So Spurs can have a good end to the season, and Spurs can look back on 2021 with some positivity, but they have to get better against big teams, James. And I wonder how they do that.
Yeah, I mean, so they've got 10 games left, and you know, you highlighted at the start of the show how bad their form has been against the clubs in the top half of the league. They've not beaten a club in the top half of the league since, I think actually had to go back to the City game in November, because Arsenal was sort of 15th in the league when Spurs beat them before. Yeah, and five of the last 10 games are against teams in the top half of the league. So yeah, clearly they're going to have to kind of find a way of doing that if they want any chance of getting to the top four. They could probably win the other five games and finish like sixth or seventh, I think, just because I think clubs are going to throw points away and it's going to be a bit of a mess. But if they want any chance of getting fourth or fifth, and obviously fifth would be kind of straight into the Europa League group stage, which I think would be quite useful given what we saw earlier this season. They're going to have to, you know, maybe not beat Manchester United, but they're certainly going to have to kind of beat Everton and Villa. Those are the kind of games they're really going to need to win. They can't afford to not win those games. So I don't necessarily think you need to massively change your approach in those games either from what they were doing against Burnley and Palace. I mean, you can't quite afford to throw caution to the wind to quite the same degree. But they should kind of back themselves to beat those teams, shouldn't they? They should have better players, man for man. I mean, I know it doesn't always work like that, but I don't really see, you know, and it's kind of a similar thing to what we saw yesterday. They had a better, if you looked at those two teams before the game, you'd say Spurs had the better team 1-11. And they've played in this sort of weirdly passive way. And if they do the same thing against teams like Villa and Everton, then, you know, you can kind of expect to get caught out in a similar fashion. It's important to sort of assert yourself on these games against teams who are sort of a similar standing. It's really, I can't really comprehend why you wouldn't do that. It is odd.
I just want to finish with some questions from readers before we wrap up. So we've got a question here from quiz winner James Lewis. Why did we treat Arsenal like we were playing their invincible side and not what they are, which is a mid-table team with some talented young attackers? Well, I feel like we've kind of covered that a bit already, but it's I definitely think, James, that it was they probably did show Arsenal a bit too much respect given where Arsenal are in the league. And
never show Arsenal respect.
Never show Arsenal respect.
Never show Arsenal respect.
one here from Luke Warner. Even if by some miracle Mourinho wins the Europa and League Cup with us, is there much a case for keeping him, given how atrocious being a Spurs fan is now most of the time? Well, this is an interesting one. Like, if they win the league and the Europa League... Well, there is an argument which says if they win the League Cup and the Europa League, Mourinho has massively succeeded and he's got the team back in the Champions League and he deserves to manage them in the Champions League, you know, because he got them there. Some people might disagree with that and say, well, but how are we going to improve on that next season? Maybe now would be the best time to make a change, hypothetically, start a new cycle, new process in the Champions League under a different manager. But then it's very hypothetical. I don't know whether the Spurs are going to win the Europa League or the League Cup, James.
Yeah, I mean, that would represent, I think, a very good season. And I think if you'd gone to any Spurs fan over the summer and said, win the League Cup and the Europa League and then finish, you know, what would it be, like 7th or 8th or whatever? I'd be surprised if there was anyone who wouldn't take that. I mean, I definitely would have taken that. But... if you're kind of throwing it forward to next season and the season beyond and the seasons beyond that, I would be slightly cautious, because, you know, for all the kind of positivity about Mourinho and giving opportunities to, you know, your Tangangas and your Joe Rodens earlier in this season and last, those two players have completely disappeared from the face of the earth in the last few weeks.
Yeah.
Like, you know, having seen how, you know, Mourinho is completely determined to make Tanganga a right back, and I think that might not be a terrible shout. And he had a very good game at City, despite the fact Spurs were terrible. So what I don't really understand, he's fit as far as I know. I don't really understand why he's not in the team. Because, I mean, Doherty, you know, with all due respect, has really struggled this season for whatever reason. And it kind of feels like you could might as well just chuck Tanganga in and just see how he gets on. Roden, obviously, again, is an even weirder one. He just, you know, having said after the mistake against Liverpool that he wouldn't kind of be dropped. He wasn't dropped. He did play the next game, but then he hasn't played since then at all. I don't think he's even been on the bench that much. It is very strange. So to the point of that ramble was, in terms of kind of throwing forward and developing players and bringing younger players through, I would be slightly concerned that you know, that despite all his kind of self-congratulatory stuff about playing Dane Scarlett, I'm not convinced that would necessarily be what would happen. So maybe that's a bigger factor in, or should be a bigger factor in the decision.
And one more here from Mark Birdie. For me, that was our worst defeat under Mourinho. We'd managed to build some momentum and confidence, albeit against teams we should be beating, and by reverting to his default negative tactics, he threw it all away. He'll never change. He has to go. James, the fact is, Mourinho is not going to go anywhere now. Whether or not he goes anywhere in the summer, I think, is still very, very much up in the air. It depends on a huge number of factors, not least how Spurs do in the next few weeks. So no, I think for now, Spurs have to succeed with Mourinho, but then let's see where we are in the summer, I think, is all I can say to that.
Yeah, I mean, I would kind of echo that tweet, really. It's incredibly frustrating to see, you know, to see things being incredibly positive for a few weeks and everyone to kind of be, okay, well, this is good, this is working. Now, Bale's in the team, we're playing well, we're attacking, we're playing on the front foot, we're playing to our strengths, we're getting results against teams who, you know, are otherwise getting results against good teams. And again, we saw Burnley beat Everton at the weekend. So to kind of go from that to reverting to type and being really passive and unambitious, yeah, it is incredibly frustrating. And I can see why people might, particularly because it was against Arsenal in a moment where I think most Spurs fans, and I think rightly, would feel that Spurs are better than Arsenal. To go there and play like that is incredibly frustrating. And it might be the straw that breaks the camel's back for quite a few people.
Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's podcast. Thanks again to James and producer Tom. Thank you to everyone who sent in some questions. I'm sorry we didn't get around to all of them, but we really enjoy your feedback and interaction. Keep sending us stuff to talk about. We'll talk about it next week. And we'll be back next week, where we'll look back on the Dinamo Zagreb second leg, the Aston Villa game, and then forward to a little bit of a break over the internationals.
The Athletic.
Hello, listeners. Sorry to interrupt your show, but we've got a small favour to ask. We're currently doing a bit of a survey to find out more about you, your podcast listening habits, and the sort of adverts that are most relevant to you. If you feel like helping, please head to surveymonkey.com/r/athleticaudiouk. That's pretty catchy, so I'll say it one more time. surveymonkey.com/r/athleticaudiouk. Thank you.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.